there is such a tremendous freedom in simply saying, you know what? I don't know. Right. And I think that's
Yes.
where you can start with vulnerability, right? It doesn't have to be baring your soul. It doesn't have to be revealing your childhood trauma. It doesn't need to be anything other than, hey guys, I'm not exactly sure how to solve this problem. What do you think? Right. It honestly starts there of being willing to say, I don't have all the answers. I really need your help. And when I think about this, I know that there are going to be some people listening to this that think this is a bunch of foo-foo garbage, right? I get it. But my guess is that there's not a single listener who thinks that they are better by themselves than they are with their team. And so if you think about being better as a team than being better by yourself, that in and of itself is vulnerability. Right? Because you need to rely on the person to the right of you. You need to rely on the person to the left of you to be as successful as possible. Right? Not that you couldn't do it by yourself, but you'll be more effective, maybe more efficient. That's where vulnerability begins.
Being rescued from a three-story apartment building.
What's your emergency?
The First Responder Liaison Network is proud to present to you the Kitchen Table Podcast. Join us as we explore leadership from perspectives around the globe, from firefighters to fire chiefs, civilians to CEOs. Our conversations have one simple goal: build more leaders.
Good afternoon and welcome everybody to the Kitchen Table. The Kitchen Table is brought to you by the First Responder Liaison Network. The network is organized for the development, implementation, and ongoing support of mentorship and professional development programs, inspiring our youth and young adults to mature into engaged civic leaders and resilient community sentinels. Music and graphics are brought to you by Kai Elephant Productions. In our leadership conversation today, we are talking yet again about vulnerability and the strength it can have in effective leadership. We're also going to talk about the importance of shared struggle and how it leads to building trust and building strong teams. We're also talking how followership can sometimes be more important than leadership. What would the fire service look like if as individuals, as teams, as crews, and as organizations, we're all just a little bit more vulnerable when leading? Our guest today started as a volunteer firefighter in his hometown of New Jersey in 1990 during his senior year of high school. He became a full-time hospital-based paramedic in 1994 and his first career job as a firefighter in 1996 in Howard County, Maryland. He then jumped coast to Gig Harbor, Washington in 1997. He served as a firefighter paramedic, lieutenant, battalion chief, and currently serves as the assistant chief of health and safety. Our guest spent 9 years as union president and founded the department's peer support team. He has a bachelor's degree in public safety and emergency management from Grand Canyon University and is currently finishing up the executive fire officer program at the National Fire Academy. Today, I welcome Assistant Chief Scott Booth to the Kitchen Table. Good afternoon, Chief. How are you today?
I'm fantastic. Thank you.
A member of the Wolfpack, a passionate and dedicated group of firefighters that have appeared on the Kitchen Table several times. And I will start with this. I didn't realize that you started in the East Coast. What brought you to the West Coast back 20 some years ago?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it's a super long story. I actually, you could take up half of our time together today if I were to actually tell it. But the short version is a series of God moments brought me out here. I was newly divorced and I was pretty unhappy being an East Coaster. I always say that it's a great place to be from. I'm glad I grew up there. I'm glad I cut my teeth as a paramedic there, but I'm also glad that I no longer live there. So,
wow, there you go. Interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, honestly, it's a crazy long story, but basically, Pierce County came on the radar when I was going somewhere. Howard County was a phenomenal place to be a firefighter. But at the time, it wasn't the best place to be a paramedic, kind of antiquated scope of practice. I worked with amazing people, and some of those people actually helped me move on. but I needed to go somewhere. And Pierce County came in a pretty surprising way, and jumped into the process. The next thing you know, I'm loading a truck and starting to drive.
Wow.
And showed up in Washington 6 days later, and I've never looked back.
Wow. So if I may ask, how is it that Pierce County, I'm just intrigued about, because I'm in King County, obviously, you're in Pierce County, the county over. I'm intrigued on how Pierce County came to the top of the list. Or how did you find them, or how did they find you?
All right, you're going to make me tell at least part of the story, and that's fine. So in Maryland, the station that I was assigned to full-time was in Clarksville. Howard County is a large combination fire department. And at this particular house, the volunteers staffed the station on Sundays. That was the only time you saw a volunteer there. You didn't routinely run calls together. They didn't come do ride-alongs. But the one position that they didn't provide was a paramedic. And so on Sundays, the paramedic would stay behind and everyone else would rove somewhere else in the county. And I was on probation at the time. And my MSO, the shift level paramedic supervisor, decided I can't leave a probationary guy out there without any supervisors, right? So on this particular Sunday, I roved into the center of the county, which is the city of Columbia. And we had it was a triple house. It was a truck, engine, and a medic. And so I rove in, and as we're heading to the morning meeting, I notice a green piece of paper on the cork board in the hallway, and stop and look at it briefly. Pierce County Medic One, paramedic test. I'll get back to the green paper in a minute. So I go into the meeting. We go do our PT. After PT, we get changed. I wander by again. I take another look at it. I take it down, take a photocopy of it, put it back up. By the time I went home the following morning, I just took it with me. And what is interesting is that the fact that it was on green paper meant that it was an original copy, an original mailing. It wasn't something that someone got emailed and they just printed. No one from Pierce County, Washington, and this was a 5-agency test. That's why it was kind of more broadly shared. So no one from Pierce County had ever heard of Howard County. And no one from Howard County had ever heard of Pierce County.
Right.
Yet this original copy of this job announcement shows up in a firehouse that I rarely work at.
Huh.
And there it is.
Talk about
that
a sign.
That is the first of a series of God moments that brought me here.
Wow. 100%. No. Yeah. You had to have looked into it at some point to find out how it ended up there, right? Somebody put it there, right?
I asked the person that ran the process and she said, I have no idea how it ended there.
Wow. That is interesting. Talk about... Yeah. You know, and we talk about that a lot, like your opportunity, you know, and it's there, not sometimes not even knowing how or why, but sometimes seeing a sign and then taking advantage. I mean, talk
exactly.
About. Exactly. Wow.
Yeah. And that's the key, right? That's the key, not to get all yeah. faith here, but the key is to recognize
yes.
the signs when they come, those opportunities, right? To recognize yeah. them. And this is true in a lot of ways, right? Yes. Not just faith or,
agreed.
Or, you know, professionally or whatever.
Agreed.
But to recognize the opportunity and then having the courage to do something about it, right? Wow. Instead of letting that opportunity pass you by.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure we'll talk a lot about that. There's something that I heard, luck is simply preparation meeting opportunity. And you can look at luck as just simply, oh, you know, that person just has good luck. Or you can be someone that is staying prepared, always prepared, and jumps on an opportunity when it's there. And there's the so-called luck. But
exactly.
I love how you said that courage too. There's a courage piece to step up and say, you know what, let's go kind of type of a deal. That's awesome. That's quite the story. And I didn't know that. So thank you for sharing. So today's topic, we actually have discussed a couple of times by a few guests. We've had Deputy Chief Aaron Tyerman out of Puget Sound early on in the podcast talked about vulnerable leadership. We actually had Battalion Chief Dina Ali a few weeks ago. She actually talked about modeling vulnerability. We've even had guests that talked about Brené Brown, referenced Brené Brown multiple times on this show from multiple guests. You know, we've talked about, you know, power of vulnerability, being vulnerable, how important it is. So I'm just going to throw it out there before we start. Vulnerability today in 2024, right? A necessary quality in being an effective leader. Just throwing it out there. So I love how where we're going to go to in today's conversation. But before we get there, would you mind sharing a little bit about who Scott Booth is? I know you talked a little bit about how you came up to that West Coast. But share a little bit about maybe your upbringing, family life, and hobbies, and then we'll just jump into leadership.
Yeah, perfect. I think my upbringing might have a lot to do with why I personally am very comfortable in vulnerability. So grew up in New Jersey, and my father was abusive, as I remember it. And he left when I was 9 years old. The reality is that I was raised by my mother and my grandmother. And maybe being raised by women has kind of taught me to be more in touch with emotions. I didn't have the idyllic childhood, but I certainly didn't struggle like a lot of folks. I was certainly on the privileged side of the fence if I had to drop myself in one place or the other. So senior year of high school, kind of funny. The reason I initially got interested in the volunteer fire department in my town, in Denville, New Jersey, was honestly what took me to this place was not at all what I found when I finally kind of got here. But so I was big in theater. That was my thing. I tried doing sports. I don't know if I was clumsy or if I just wasn't athletically inclined, but so I did theater. And in Jersey, you may or may not know this, but there's diners everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And so a West Coast thing, West Coast doesn't have diners, but I guess Denny's is the closest thing to a diner. But diners are they're just part of that New England, East sure. Coast, just culture, right?
Sure.
So anyway, after a performance, we go to a diner. That's just kind of the way it went. And we were in this diner one night, and one of the guys, he was a volunteer firefighter. And so their pager went off, and they jumped up, and he told his sister, who was there as well, you know, she's like, be safe. And he ran out. And I thought, oh man, I want to do that. That was it. That's what first got me interested.
Wow. Yeah.
Is how cool it looked.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, small town, show up. They gave me a blue light for my car and a helmet and a pair of long boots and a long coat and said, if this thing beeps, drive to the firehouse as fast as you can and don't get killed. And that was it.
Wow.
That was the extent of my onboarding.
There
right?
You go. Yes.
And that was 1990. And so, 90.
Okay.
over the course of things, I had a fantastic EMS captain. Ed Wisniewski was his name. He was a full-time paramedic at a local hospital. And then he volunteered on the side and actually owned I think he was either a plumber or an electrician. I can't remember which, but he had a company vehicle. Anyway, I initially went to college for law enforcement, promptly failed out of all those classes, but was volunteering in the local town, Spring Garden Township, Pennsylvania. And it was a combination department. They had two drivers and one officer was the entire career for the shift in two stations. And so really the volunteers just did everything.
Yeah.
And so immersed myself in there, became a resident. So anyway, flunked out of college, head back to New Jersey and got myself into the paramedic program. You know, 2 short years later, I was a certified paramedic working in 4 different places, just trying to make a living and seeing a ton of critical patients, just high volume, urban EMS, just loved every minute of it. The job in Maryland, I'm telling way too much of the story. The job in Maryland was another one of those God moments. I just sent my resume to every county in Maryland that had paramedics. That was it.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, someone called me and said, you want to take a test? I was like, sure.
Yeah.
Went down, took a test. And they said, hey, you want a job? I said, sure.
Yeah. There you go. Hey, opportunity again, taking advantage.
It was crazy. Anyway. Yeah. So we already know about getting frustrated with my experience in Maryland, jumping coasts.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I'm a 27-year veteran in this organization. It's changed considerably since the day I got here. I was hired on to open a third station with just an ambulance. Nowadays, we have 5 station staff with 5 engines, 3 medics. We still don't have a truck. We didn't have a battalion chief at the time. Now we have a battalion chief. It's remarkable. You know,
absolutely.
It was a large volunteer department with a small career complement. And nowadays our only volunteers are the chaplains that I have the privilege of working with and overseeing. I have a beautiful wife. Her name is Amy. We've been married for 23 or 24 years. We have 2 kids between the 2 of us, Jordan and Sheldon. And we have 2 dogs. We're empty nesters now. So we have 2 dogs that we treat like little human beings.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And life is really good.
That's good.
Hobbies. I'm an avid cyclist. I, I ride my, I, when I was on shift, I was a year round bike commuter, did some cyclocross racing, do a little gravel. I mostly stay on the road. But that's really kind of one of my big passions. And I still play drums, started when I was a kid, and I've been kind of on and off the drums over the years. Used to play in a bunch of different churches, but now I just play in my basement.
Awesome. Hobbies. Yeah. Something to do. Some, now, where do you live? Are you in Pierce County?
I live in University Place.
Okay.
So
okay.
Just the other side of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. Yeah. I don't know why I picked UP. Yeah. When I first moved here, you know, I was flown out to kind of figure out where you're going to live, get your uniform fitting, that kind of thing. And, and I just picked a apartment complex in UP.
There you go.
And I've stayed there ever since.
Oh, wow.
So,
all right. Yeah. Wow. Well, I was in your neck of the woods just a week ago. We had actually a week ago today was the Lionheart golf tournament. The one that, yes. Renton Firefighters and, I was invited last minute. Over to play over there, and I know Chief Doan obviously plays at Cantrawood Golf and Country Club, and that's where I thought of all you guys, because we could hear, you know, the trucks go out, and it was Gig Harbor Fire. I was like, oh yeah, there's those guys, and I, you know, meet with Scott Booth next week, and so it just reminded me, because I don't go to that side very often. Usually, actually, when I do go over there, it's probably for some kind of golf, because you guys have great golf down there in the South. Love golf down there. So, anyways, So, well, thank you for sharing. It's an amazing story, and I'm honored and privileged to have you on the show today, and I'm very excited to talk about the topic today. So vulnerability and effective leadership, that is the topic that you have your EFO paper revolved around. But before we get into that, let's talk about the EFO. So at the National Fire Academy, how far are you into the EFO? And tell us about your experience there, and then we'll get right into vulnerability and all that.
I think I got accepted in 2021. So just coming out of COVID, and they were in the process of overhauling the program.
That's right.
So I'm in what's considered EFO 2.0.
Okay. Do you want? Okay.
Yeah. So the prior fire chief, John Burgess, who's now one of our chaplains, actually, he's the one that endorsed me. I was blessed to compete against some of the best in the country and got in on my first ever application. And so it's been a really, really cool process. I'm no more than a month away from being done, actually.
Oh, congratulations.
I fly out. Yeah, thank you. I fly out to Maryland on the 12th of October for my last class. Wow. And then I'll be done. Wow. I can't believe it happened as quick as it did, even though I have some classmates that I was in class with who are already done. They just put the hammer down.
That's awesome.
It's been an amazing experience. Again, I don't have any experience with what EFO 1.0 look like.
Sure.
Chief Doan is an EFO grad. Mm-hmm. I know several EFO grads. And I'll just speak for what EFO 2.0 is.
Yes.
EFO 2.0 is all about getting you more aware of what you think, how you think, and why you think it. And so it really challenges you to confront your biases, to try to understand why you think certain things. It challenges you to look at your organization from a more objective perspective, instead of kind of falling into the subjectivity that we're all prone to, right? Yep. And then it really challenges you to look at your community and to try to really understand what your community's needs are. And so those are the first three classes. It's a study of self, organization, and community. And then you sit down and you write your paper, which we'll get into here today. And then we finish. The majority of what we do when we go back for the last class is a study of Gettysburg. And we dig deep. We go out through the battlefields with a professional guide, and we talk about some of the key leaders through the Battle of Gettysburg. And I'm getting really excited for it.
The more research
I do. Yeah, wow. It's been one of those things. I think this happened kind of organically. I know there have been instructors in the past who have been kind of Gettysburg buffs, and it was always kind of like a side thing that they do over the long weekend, but it was never something that was required. And now it's a requirement to graduate, and I think it's an excellent addition.
Absolutely.
To the curriculum, is to kind of take a look at it from one more perspective that a lot of people wouldn't take the time to think about. I've never been a history buff. I hated history when I was in high school, but now that I'm older, like a lot of things, right? You begin to get new appreciation for things, and history is one of them. And I've been fascinated by some of the things I've learned about the Battle of Gettysburg in this in the last couple of weeks as I've been prepping. So yeah, it's right around the corner. I'm almost
Well, congratulations. That's quite the accomplishment. And well, I mean, it talk about inspiring for others to learn about, hear about. A question that I have briefly is, who is the EFO for? Who is the target audience? I kind of know the answer to that question, but I kind of want your insight. Who is it for?
Yeah, so the very first day, I think it was the very first day of the first class when we showed up, the instructor said, if you're here, it should be because you want to be the fire chief someday. And while I appreciate that, and clearly that's definitely part of it, I don't necessarily think that you have to be the fire chief to take something meaningful away from EFO. I think EFO is for any leader. It's definitely for leaders, but for any leader who's interested in maybe exploring more about themselves, about think if you got anybody in your organization who's like an outside of the box thinker, this is probably for them because they're challenging the cultural norms.
Yes.
They are looking to, you know, for innovative ways to do things. They are not happy with, well, we just do it that way because we've always done it that way.
Yes.
Anyone who doesn't fall into that mold, I think is the right fit.
Yes.
Now it is an extremely competitive process.
Absolutely.
I think they opened applications earlier this year. The plan was for the application period to be open for 60 days. And I think they had their max number of applicants in like 16.
Wow.
So it's super competitive. There's a lot of folks that are interested in being involved.
Yeah.
But I don't want to discourage anyone either because
right.
My EFO classmates are a broad swath from the fire service.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes us right so unique and so powerful is because we are so diverse.
Yep. Well, that's kind of the reason I asked that question is this being a leadership podcast, and I know not all of our listeners are obviously aspiring to be fire chiefs, right, wrong, or indifferent. That's okay. But what I believe, and in my personal leadership is being a good leader doesn't have, I mean, we've heard this, it sounds very cliche. It's not for a certain individual. It's not for a rank. It's not for a tenure. Leadership there's qualities attached to it that I believe anyone and everyone, especially someone in the public service, can attach onto to better themselves to then be able to provide better for others. So my point being is, are there qualities, are there learnings that individuals can take away from an EFO program that aren't necessarily aspiring fire chiefs?
And yeah, absolutely.
And so I guess the question I have, would candidates be denied, if you will, if on an application it was an exploration piece, for example, like they applied to get the EFO program and was not aspiring to be, say, a fire chief, but was more of wanting to better themselves to become a very effective leader at whatever rank that may be? Would that be a deterrent of an applicant?
Yeah, I don't know that anyone asks you, you know, there's like a box check,
right.
You know, do you aspire to be the fire chief?
Right.
I don't remember that being part of the application process, but I've been in class with company officers, battalion officers. When I started the program, when I applied, I was a lieutenant. When I got accepted, I was a battalion chief. And while I was at class, I got promoted to assistant chief. The reality is that, you know, if you're a tailboard firefighter, probably aren't going to be competitive.
Right.
Against, you know, the group. But if you are in a position of leadership and you have, you know, aspirations to be more effective,
yes,
I would think that alone wouldn't, you know, disqualify you.
Yeah. And I mentioned that simply for this, those listeners out there. I mean, we talk leadership. Here's another opportunity to encourage you all to consider maybe the EFO program. I understand that did they revamp the managing fire officer program, or is that still in its 1.0?
Yeah, I believe I have a guy in my organization that just finished.
He
just graduated, and Lieutenant Robert Witherspoon. And I want to say that as he was finishing, they're in the process of revamping
it.
So I don't have a good finger on the pulse of exactly when that's supposed to reopen and launch in the version 2.0, but I do know that after their experience over the last several years, they are looking to make some changes.
There you go. For those listeners out there, there's two awesome opportunities to consider to up your leadership arsenal, if you will. It's something to look into for whether it be now or something in your future aspirations, the EFO program and the Managing Fire Officer program at the National Fire Academy. So why don't we just jump into this? So your topic of choice for your EFO paper was vulnerability and effective leadership. How did that become your topic of choice to write about? I mean, there's obviously dozens and dozens of topics you could have picked, geared toward, whatever, but that was your topic. Why is that?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. I have been thinking about how I kind of wandered into this. I would say that I've always had a propensity toward vulnerability, just leaning into that. But again, like I kind of suggested early on, raised by women, you know, in theater, you need to portray a lot of emotions, get very comfortable with emotion. It was just the way I chose to lead. And I think back to one of my favorite teams was a crew that I was able to lead. We transcended that typical crew dynamic. You know, we genuinely loved and cared for each other. And so anyway, I walk away from that experience with that kind of in the back of my head, like, man, if I'm going to write something, I feel like I should do this. So there's a story behind this. So on day, I think it was the afternoon of day one of the first EFO class, we did an exercise as a group, and it was kind of one of those icebreakers. And so we were each given a large sheet of paper. We made a four quadrant out of it, and we were supposed to draw pictures. And the first picture was your childhood years. The second picture was your teen years. The third picture was like your professional life. And the fourth picture is supposed to be what you view as your retirement. And so everyone takes, you know, 20 minutes, and everyone's drawing their pictures. And so I'm sitting there. I don't know any of these people, right? I mean, right. I might have spoken to the people that were sitting at my table, but I don't know anyone in this room yet. I've never met the instructors before. And I did what I would do in a situation like this, and I just led with vulnerability. And so for my childhood, it was a face crying. for my teen, it was the two masks of theater. I don't know if you're familiar with that thing, the smiling face and the crying and the sad face kind of thing. For my professional, I don't even remember what I wrote. And for retirement, it was like a bike and sunny or whatever. And so I went first for no other reason than I was sitting at the right front corner of the room. And I stood up and I explained my thing. And I had numerous people come to me afterwards saying, holy crap. Like, as soon as you did that, I was like, oh, it's going to be like this. Okay. And so it took us, you know, an hour or more to get through the class. And most people were really open and a little raw with the way they explained their pictures. And several people came to me afterward and said, because you were vulnerable, wow, I chose to be vulnerable too.
Wow.
Right. So that was the first kind of like, hey. And then I met with one of the, cause you start thinking about your capstone right away. You don't actually get it approved for quite a while, but you need to be thinking about it and researching it from the very beginning. And one of the instructors said, I kind of feel like you should do something about vulnerability. And I was like, okay.
Wow.
All right. Yeah. And so it took a little time for me to kind of develop a true research valid hypothesis, if you will. Yep. It's not a hypothesis in qualitative research, but same kind of thing, right? It took me a little while to kind of knock the edges off it and make it something that I thought was valid for my capstone. But it really started. It started there. It started before there, but it really started in that room where I've led with vulnerability because that's just what felt right.
Yeah.
And I saw the impact it had.
Wow. I mean, talk about like, cause this is one thing that I've always, thought. Like, you can't. So you mentioned, like, you led, right? You modeled vulnerability, being the first one in the room, talk about setting the tone, you know, and people coming up to you and saying, wow, like, through your presentation, if you will, it allowed me to want to be more vulnerable. I mean, I can only, and this is something you can't quantify, right? It's like things that you, that's the tough part about being proactive, is you can't quantify the alternative. So I only can imagine how not vulnerable some would have been had you not been the first one to go. And so I talk about how powerful that was, setting the tone for yourself, your class, the paper that you wrote. And I think that's just that's so key. And we talked about model. In fact, Dina Ali, who's on the show, our previous guest, talked about exactly what you're saying, just modeling vulnerability. So I guess a question that I have is, how does one, right? So you're an assistant chief. You've got decades of experience in the fire service. How does one get to the point where you said, you know what, I'll go first and I am going to model vulnerability because I think it's important to me. Like, let's, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chief, if this 20 years ago, maybe you wouldn't have had that courage, if you will, to be able to do so. How does one build themselves up so they're not waiting, we'll say 30 years into their career and saying, all right, now I'm in the seat I'm in, I've got 30 years in, and now I'm going to start modeling vulnerability. Because I right, we want our people to be able to be vulnerable through the entirety of their careers. So I know it's kind of a question that might have, you know, way many answers, but, you know, going with vulnerability, how do we encourage people that vulnerability is okay?
That's a great question. I'll just focus on my career. Thinking back over my time as a professional, when I think about how difficult it is to try to be always right, always perfect, I'm the guy that's here to save things, I don't need help, right? You think about all those negative influences that actually Dina also talked about, really challenges our behavioral health. Mm-hmm. There is such a tremendous freedom in simply saying, you know what, I don't know, right? And I think that's where you can start with vulnerability, right? It doesn't have to be bearing your soul. It doesn't have to be revealing your childhood trauma. It doesn't need to be anything other than, hey guys, I'm not exactly sure how to solve this problem. What do you think? Right? It honestly starts there, of being willing to say, I don't have all the answers. I really need your help. And when I think about this, I know that there are going to be some people listening to this that think this is a bunch of foo-foo garbage, right? I get it. But my guess is that there's not a single listener who thinks that they are better by themselves than they are with their team. And so if you think about being better as a team than being better by yourself, that in and of itself is vulnerability, right? Because you need to rely on the person to the right of you. You need to rely on the person to the left of you to be as successful as possible, right? Not that you couldn't do it by yourself, but you'll be more effective, maybe more efficient. That's where vulnerability begins. And for a lot of folks listening to this, like, it's harder now for me. I work in an office environment. I have a team, right? But we're not running calls. It's harder for me, and harder. I show a different kind of vulnerability to the people I lead now than the people that I was leading when we were on an engine company together.
Sure.
Right? Because the context is different, because the stakes are different.
Yes.
Because the work product that we're spending time in is different.
Yep.
So maybe my vulnerability now is more personal and making the people I'm working with feel valued and important. The reality is that, you know, I know they already know this, but they're way smarter than me. They're the ones that make everything happen. I'm just the one that is able to help make sure that they can be successful.
Successful, yes, agreed.
Right?
Agreed.
So, but when you're on a fire crew, man, the team is what wins the day.
Yes.
And everyone has a role for sure. But any company officer who doesn't think that those firefighters are the ones that make the magic might be fooling themselves.
Yeah.
They might want to rethink their perspective. And the same is true for the battalion chief.
Yep.
Sitting in the buggy. Right. If you think for a second that everyone's waiting for you to tell them what to do, you're fooling yourself.
Yeah, totally agree. I absolutely agree. What's What's shared struggle? I think you wrote that. You talked about that in your paper, right?
Yeah. One of my research participants brought it up, and it was a theme. I don't remember I managed to get all my interviews in a single week, which was, I couldn't believe
how it fell
together. But one of my research participants brought that up first, and then it became a theme that really shined out in all of my interviews, not all, in many of my interviews. And it was, some of the examples were on the drill ground, doing a really hard evolution together. Some of it was like solving a complex problem. Maybe there's a challenging thing. We recently went through a schedule change, and maybe it was, the work of researching that and then presenting it, not only to the membership, but then to administration to get them to, to buy in, to do it on a trial or whatever the case may be. The theme was that those shared struggles, those opportunities to really work hard together. And I think there's an element of vulnerability in working hard together, because inherently when you work really, really hard, there's always an element of weakness that shines through, right? Sure. Like I've got a huge aerobic engine, but I'm not the strongest guy.
Sure.
Right. And so if I'm working side by side with another firefighter, it's very likely that they are stronger than me. But I can go all day.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And so there's that show of strength and weakness. And it's because the two of us are together that we can be successful.
Absolutely.
Is because we complement each other.
Yes. That's a good way to put it.
Compliment. And so that shared struggle was something that came out of the research that I wasn't searching for. That just happened organically. None of my research questions kind of specifically teased that key thing out, but it was one that several of the participants shared, is that was a quick way to build trust in a team is to struggle together.
To struggle together.
And the reason why I really keyed into that is because organizationally, Gig Harbor, we serve a fantastic community, but if you're looking to fight fire every day, this is not the place you want to come work. On average, we fight a fire a month total, not
right.
per shift,
right.
not per station, right? Total. And so, whenever you come out of a fire, everyone's, high-fiving and spiking the ball. And we couldn't feel more accomplished and satisfied in the work we do. But in an organization like this, if you're waiting for that, you're going to be pretty unhappy. And so I really think that's a call to action of the company officers or the senior firefighters or even the junior firefighters to find opportunities to create shared struggle.
Yes.
And don't just wait for it to happen, because then you're missing so many opportunities if you're just sitting back like, as soon as we get that big fire, then we can struggle together.
No, and I love that, because I actually wrote it down right here. It's you wrote, as a leader, one should create opportunities or a team or a crew to struggle together instead of relying on those, on chance to offer those situations. So I think that's one thing that is kind of an action item in and of itself, is like when we're out doing our drills, when we're out prepping for a training session, are we creating opportunities to just go train where it's going to be a high success rate, which there's a time and place for that as well, right? We don't need every drill to kick everyone's ass just to feel like they're a failure. Although there's there's opportunities for learning in those environments as well. But I think that's one thing that we can inject as leaders, like what you said, is, are we creating a training, a drill, a session, whatever it may be, where there's an opportunity for us to struggle with that drill together, to figure it out together, to know that failure is okay, but we're going to go through this together as a crew, because we're going to be able to become better at the end of it. And then we show our vulnerabilities within those drills together. And I think that's how we can grow together. So I love that piece. And that was a quote straight, I believe, from your paper, right?
Yes.
As a leader, one should create opportunities for a team or crew to struggle together instead of relying on chance to offer those situations. So the next question I have about vulnerability is, how do you know when, as a leader, for example, how does one know when vulnerability has worked or not worked? For example, like, how do you measure that versus, let's just say some would view that vulnerability can be a weakness, right?
Totally.
How would one know that expressing vulnerability has worked to then better the team dynamic or better the environment?
Yeah, that's a really interesting, informed question based on my paper. This is a qualitative research study, right? Yeah. So it's 100% subjective. Yeah. You try to provide some objectivity, with consistent questioning, but at the end of the day, it is subjective. I think about that team that I was part of, that I had the pleasure of leading, and what I would say, how I knew that we had accomplished something that I hadn't experienced before, and have experienced, I have experienced it since, but not the same way, if that makes sense, is we genuinely loved each other. And it was evident in everything we did. It was evident in the way that we supported each other, doing the routine, mundane stuff around the station.
Yeah.
It was evident in the way that we cared for each other, both on and off duty. It was evident in the interest that we took in each other. I'll just use the one example. I am not someone who fishes. I don't care for fishing. I don't know, maybe it's the ADD.
I don't fish either.
The idea of sitting there and just doing nothing, I can't do it. Right. So, but there was a guy on my crew, Greg Hoshin. He's now a lieutenant, and Greg lives to fish. It was one of the most important things in his life. And so when I was at work and when I was sitting there with Greg, fishing was the most important thing to me. Not because I had any interest in it, because it mattered to him.
Yeah.
Right. And so we would talk about fishing. Conversely, I'm a huge cycling nut.
Yep.
And so those guys would wake up in the morning and they'd watch bicycle racing with me.
Yep.
When they could have cared less,
yes,
about some guys running around in spandex on bikes. Like who even cares about this? But they would legitimately, with interest, sit there and watch with me because it mattered to me. And that may be one of the ways, and again, you won't know that unless you know each other, you know, very, very well. But it was that genuine care and affection for each other. That's how I knew that we were effective as a team. That's how I knew that being vulnerable and real with each other, it did something.
Absolutely. And what I was going to say, because what I heard from that is, I suppose one thing, obviously subjective as well, that you know that vulnerability has worked or it's effective is the relationships that are built at the end of the day, right? Like if you are the way that you're leading each other, the way you're leading a crew, the way you're working and interacting with each other, and you know that you're being vulnerable in the way that you act, the way that you lead, the way that you operate, is that the relationships built are strong versus not.
Yeah.
And I think
there you go. You said it better than me.
Well, no. I said it because of what you said and it got it out of me, but I think that's one thing that I think we can all agree with. I think all listeners here as well is when we are vulnerable, basically what we're doing is we're being our true selves, right? Because if you're not being vulnerable, you're holding back. How strong of a relationship can you have with somebody, a crew member or other, if you're not being your true self? And I think, you know, with how strong a relationship one has with their crew is strongly based upon how vulnerable you can be.
And hearing your observation, I have maybe it got me to think of something else. Maybe the way that you gauge the effectiveness of your vulnerability is how willing your team is to be vulnerable with you.
Agreed.
Right. Yep. And so, you know, that's another observation out of the paper, out of the interviews, was that not only does vulnerability build trust and prove psychological safety and all those things, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But several members said that, you know, when I'm vulnerable, it tells you that it's okay if you're vulnerable.
Absolutely.
Right. And so you're modeling the type of behavior that you want the people you're working with to also, you know, express.
Absolutely. And what environment would we have or want or be working in if nobody was vulnerable, right?
Exactly.
I mean, to be as cliche as that sounds, but I mean, I think we would all agree that vulnerability is a necessity in the work that we do. Yeah. If the leader's not going to model it themselves, can we really expect others to bring their true selves to the table to work every day? And I think the answer to that is no.
Yeah.
So what I hear from a lot of this as well, Chief, and we've talked about this in a previous episode when the Wolfpack was on, but we talked a little bit about emotional intelligence. So I think there's a lot of emotional intelligence in here when we're talking about vulnerability, right? We're talking about self-awareness as well. We're talking about understanding how one how would you best say it, how one interacts with others. But how much of this paper was influenced or not influenced by emotional intelligence? Was that part of your study? Was it part of your research? Because I hear a lot of emotional intelligence in this when we're talking about being vulnerable, specifically in the paper that you wrote. Was it?
Honestly, no. It was not. And you're not wrong. It does feel very in line. Understanding and managing one's own emotions. The ability to empathize with others. And then there's the five key elements of emotional intelligence. You already mentioned one, self-awareness. But there's also self-regulation, motivation, basically your own personal why, the ability to be empathetic, and then highly developed social skills. And so, that's all very much in line with, I think, what needs to be in place.
Yes.
If you're going to effectively model vulnerability, for sure. You had asked me a question in the previous podcast with the Wolf Pack. You asked, how does one develop emotional intelligence? That you start by digging into yourself, right? And that is largely what the EFO program has challenged me and my classmates with. Is better understanding ourselves, right?
Yep.
And so whether it's, I've come in developing my organization's peer support program, whether it's supposed to or it just happened this way, I've done a lot of behavioral health programming, trying to improve the members, their own awareness to be more resilient mentally. I've come to the conclusion, and I've had some legitimate psychologists agree with me, so I don't think it's half baked, that a lot of us that get into this profession, we come here because we're trying to correct a wrong. And I think a lot of us have experienced challenges, traumas, whatever in our lives. And I think that if you're going to become an emotionally intelligent person, let alone leader, you really need to start by digging deep and doing the hard work. I think it's a shame when anyone who's in their adult years, who's living a life that is filled with challenges, many self-imposed, that they don't take the time to try to dig into those things that they don't want to talk about, right? I already talked about my abusive father. I was also abused by the next father figure that came into my life. I've had my share of things, and I can talk about them now because of the work that I've done in counseling, in better understanding kind of what those created, the self-destructive behavior patterns that I was living my life through. And that is how you get to being someone who is more self-aware, who's able to regulate their emotions, right? I was someone that was, rage was a term that was often used when people talked about me. And that was because of what I'd experienced and not having processed it and not having effective ways to deal with it.
Yeah.
That was a byproduct of, for sure. I can say that with crystal clarity now that I'm in my early 50s. I think that's how you become an emotionally intelligent person, leader. Yeah. And that's how you get closer and closer to being comfortable with being vulnerable.
Absolutely. And you, I think we talked about this. You mentioned the podcast that we did earlier on is, I think I asked you this question and they talked about emotional intelligence to an extent in the EFO program, right? When, going back 10 years, 20 years, we weren't talking about emotional intelligence, right? We weren't talking about self-awareness. We weren't talking about self-regulation. We were talking about hard skills with the job, this and that. So I love the fact that, this is a topic that's being discussed at that level. But do you believe that emotional intelligence, vulnerability, things that we've talked about, is that going to start becoming mainstream earlier in development of firefighters and company officers in the career? Or are we still needing to wait to get into an EFO program or going to the National Fire Academy to really bridge these what we would say, I think most of us would say, are necessary characteristics in leaders.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're not going to hear less of it. And I think we're already hearing. I have it written down here, and you didn't say it, so I didn't get a chance to correct you, but I don't love the term soft skills.
Sure.
Because when you compare soft and hard, it's kind of like strong and weak.
Good point.
I don't like that. I prefer human skills. And so I think we're already being more aware and more purposeful about acknowledging the human skills, developing the human skills. I don't know about your fire department or the fire departments of anyone else who may be listening today, but I know my fire department is hiring a lot of people that don't look like the people they hired 20 years ago. Right. Many, and actually there's some significant weaknesses in that for sure. Right. It used to be blue collar, a lot of tradespeople. Honestly, we had a ton of people who came with experience from volunteer time.
Yep.
That's not who we're getting anymore.
Right.
Right. Because for several reasons. The biggest reason I think is that the volunteer programs don't exist anymore.
Agreed.
At least not around where I'm working. And we're pulling a lot of people out of other professions. You know, we've got attorneys, mm-hmm. we've got physical therapists, we've got, counselors that are coming into a job with the fire department. We've got all these people that are highly educated,
yes.
that have a wealth of experience in another area, and they are critical thinking people.
Yes.
Right. They are more in touch because outside of our career, and it's not just our career, but the kind of the macho ego driven thing is not popular in American culture anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably some areas where that's still celebrated, but I think in a lot of places, definitely in Western Washington, that is not highly regarded and what we try to model and push in our culture.
Agreed.
One of the reasons why I love being here and why I'm so glad that I'm from New Jersey and I'm hardcore Washingtonian, right?
Yeah.
Is because of the way we are here. If you want to be a leader in today's fire service, at least in this region, you have to be someone who's got some mastery of the human skills. Otherwise, you will not be successful.
That's powerful. So let's elaborate a little bit further on that. So with those human skills, right? And you talked about like not going to necessarily be successful, or say highly successful, we'll say. What are fire departments providing that type of training of human skills? And if not, as we talk about it as being action-oriented, you know, recommendations for listeners to start, you know, being a little more self-aware as they listen. How does one say, you know what? That is an area that I'm actually lacking in. I've got the skills, and we'll use not just necessarily hard skills, soft skills, but I've got the skill set in whatever it may be. Would it be, you know, I'm a good tactician. I'm a great yep. EMT paramedic, but what I am lacking in, or not even say lacking, let's just use I'm underdeveloped in mm-hmm. the human skills. How does one say, you know what? Let me go find out who's delivering that type of training so I could become better. How do we do that?
Yeah, you're just full of great questions, Dylan. There are truly not a lot of people that are talking about this, that are focusing on this. I certainly do not know of a education program or a class that this is the the centerpiece.
Right.
I think if I was someone who was looking for opportunities. And a lot of the modern leadership thinkers are really rooted in this. But if I were looking to develop that skill set to offset to just go in concert with a hard skill set, I think the best way to accomplish that is in reading, right?
Yes.
And so absolutely. As I look over at my desk here with all the books I've got, you've already mentioned Brené Brown.
Mm-hmm.
She's fantastic for some of these things. I love Simon Sinek.
Yes.
If I were to talk about any one person that I think has got a solid handle on how to lead a team and how to lead a team well. It's Simon Sinek. And so anything that he writes or does the snippets on YouTube, you can, yeah, that's the great thing about our modern technological world is you can consume this in any way you want.
Yeah.
Right. If you don't want to read, don't read. Watch yeah. YouTube videos. Yeah. Listen to a book on whatever the audiobook thing is.
Yeah.
Right. You can get this information in so many different ways that there really is no excuse for anyone not to begin injecting themselves with some of these concepts and ideas.
Agreed.
So that's probably where you find it.
Yeah.
Maybe you and I need to get together and put together a leadership program that focuses on human skills.
Well, okay. So here we are, because I think we will talk offline about that, because this is something that I'm passionate about. I can't do alone. Some colleagues and mentors of mine are trying to get something off the ground. But here's a question I have, and I apologize if this is a little direct, and we'll edit this out if needed, but it's a question that I'm truly passionate about. So I'm just going to go ahead and throw it out there. Whether it be your organization, maybe my organization, regionally, a fire service tradition, whatever it may be, maybe all of the above, maybe some of the above. We have task books that say, or qualifications, requirements, mm-hmm. if you will, to become company officers. Now, there's going to be a certain level of, you have to be this many years of service. You have to have gone through, you know, command training for X amount of days or hours. You need to have these certifications and classes regarding, you know, fire officer, blah, blah, blah. So I haven't seen any that are human skill development. So you right. being an assistant chief here, chief, is that something, as we sit here and talk about the importance of it, is that something that's on your radar to say, you know what, I know the fire service traditionally isn't, you know, that's not what we are all about. I know there's contractual issues, labor, you know, labor management type stuff, but at what point are we saying, you know what, in addition to having a 2-year degree in fire service, in addition to taking a 1-week command class, we are saying now that emotional intelligence training is now a part of that requirement, because we recognize that human skill development is a necessity, more so today than we'll just say 30 years ago, even though you can argue 30 years ago, it was just as important. It just was not recognized or talked about nearly as much. So is this something that you are hoping that maybe your fire department, you as an assistant chief, are saying, you know what, we are going to start making this a part of our development, our company officers? I will say, before you answer that question, and I want to always preface this, that yes, I agree with you 100%. It is every individual's responsibility and opportunity to go out there and find the books, watch the YouTube videos, because there is a wealth of information that is at the fingertips, something that we didn't have access to 20 years ago. There was no YouTube, there was no Audible, you know, there was no Amazon Prime where you could have the book here by 2 p.m., you know, and it's 1 o'clock, it could be here an hour. So it's everyone's opportunity to say, I am going to do this because I want to better myself. But now going back to the question, are you and our leaders in roles such as yourselves thinking about, you know what, let's add this to the arsenal of our company officer development or leader development?
Yeah, that am I personally thinking about it? No, I don't know that I am. I know that my department's training chief, Scott Corrigan, who's pretty well known regionally. He does some instructing. I think he does instructing internationally, actually. He has been injecting some of this into the regular officers training opportunities that we do have. And those are, and admittedly, that's for existing officers. And actually, it's really for anybody. It's for those on the list. It's really for we don't turn anyone away. So even awesome. If a young aspiring firefighter was like, I want to go to officers training, I mean, I could pay for it, but I can sit in the room and I can take it in, right?
Absolutely.
And so he has been injecting some of those topics.
Nice.
Into the routine training, but it is not structured.
Right.
And you're right. There is no task book that talks about how to be a good listener, how to show empathy, right? You know, how to be vulnerable with those that you work with in a responsible way,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, you know, the paper revealed that there's probably some irresponsible ways to express vulnerability that could undermine your credibility, right? So no, nobody is working on it. This will be a pitch. I don't know if nobody's working on it. Nobody's working on it in my organization that I'm aware of. I will throw another pitch out there for the NFA though. If you're looking to do training in the fire service related areas, and you're not looking to have to wear your bunker gear, the NFA is the place for you. there is very little that happens on at the NFA that's hands-on. I think fire investigation when it might be one of the few exceptions to that. But it's all about how you think, how you, right? How you, that's where it focuses is on those non-hands-on skills.
Yes. Okay.
Right. And maybe that's another way to say hands-on versus non-hands-on for hard versus human or whatever.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's another plug, for the National Fire Academy.
Absolutely.
Not to mention, the value that comes from getting together in a room with people who are not where you're from, who are not from where you're from.
Exactly.
And just getting all those unique experiences, those unique perspectives. It not only tells you that everyone's got the same problems you've got, but there's a brotherhood and a sisterhood that comes from sitting and breaking bread. And how do you handle this? How do you handle this? I've had this problem. What do you think? Oh, I solved that problem a year ago. Here's what I did. Like all that is immeasurable.
Absolutely.
As far as value.
Yeah. Thank you. So the National Fire Academy is something that we should all at least entertain, right? At some
totally.
Point. It's definitely something that I aspire to attend, to go to take classes, to be a part of a program at some point in my career. But it sounds like this is definitely a resource, something that leaders should definitely entertain at some point in their career. Can you talk about the role of followership in leadership? I mean, I know followership is important. Yes, it goes without saying. But talk about, being a good follower and what that means to you and why it's important in being a good, effective leader.
Yeah. I think followership is critical, not only valuable, but critical to leadership. And what I mean is, I think the example that I can use to illustrate this best is the way we do acting officers. So in my organization, if you aspire to be a lieutenant, as an example, you take a test, right? Everyone does that. In my organization, the only way to act, the only way to be the substitute teacher, if you will, is to be on that list. And that gives you the opportunity to jump into the seat every now and then. And so think about how challenging it would be if on the day you're a follower, you're constantly challenging authority, you're kind of being a jackass, you're being disruptive, you're probably breaking some rules, and then one day a month, let's say, you sit in the seat and you're suddenly the person who's the leader. Mm-hmm. And you're suddenly the person who's supposed to hold people accountable and get the most, it's a day, right? But to get the most out of people, to keep the train on the rails. And I think what a lot of new leaders, well, I think it's two different ways. If you are someone who aspires to be a formal leader, you need to start being a good follower today, because you are showing everyone around you what you expect. You don't even realize it. What you expect when you're the leader, you're modeling that behavior, whether you know it or not. Conversely, when you are a formal leader and you disagree with a decision at the next level above you, two levels above you, and you go back to the firehouse and you start talking smack about that idiot ops chief, doesn't know what he's talking about, he's forgotten where he came from, blah, 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 you're showing the people that you're formally leading that they can badmouth you behind your back. Or if you choose to willfully violate a policy, and I say that intentionally, because we all make mistakes, right? In the grand scheme of things, we all may miss the mark on something. Chief Doan says it really, really well. If it's legal, if it's ethical, and you can, and you'll help somebody, then go ahead and do it. Right. He wants to be a, now I'm going to forget the way he says it. He wants to be a, you could either be a policy driven organization, or you can be a, I can't think of the word he uses. At any rate, he doesn't want us to be overladen with policies.
Right. So handcuffed by the word versus doing the right thing, more or less.
Exactly. And so when you willfully violate a policy in front of those you lead, you show them it's okay for them to pick and choose which policy they choose to follow and not follow.
Yeah.
Right. Everything you do in followership has a direct relationship to leadership.
Leadership, yeah. That's a good way of
putting
it. Right?
And we all start as followers.
Yes, we do.
Everybody starts as a follower.
Yep. Yep.
Right? And so I've said it before, probably overstated it, but I think followership is almost more important than leadership. Right? I think one of the things that you can do as a leader is to be an exceptional follower of those that you are following.
Absolutely. Right?
Because you just model that behavior of how you want people to treat you.
Yeah.
And if you, again, if you have any interest at any point in your career of being a leader someday, you really should take stock of how you're following.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
Because today, some of those people will be around in 5 years when you finally decide it's time to promote.
Yeah.
And they're going to be like, wait a minute.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You can't turn a switch and say, I'll act this way. But when I make a decision to do that, then I'll stop. Right.
Exactly.
It comes back to modeling behavior, like you said. And it's, I mean, I love how you say it. Followership is something that we all are. And that's the thing too, is even when followers become formal leaders, we'll say, you are still a follower in many aspects. Absolutely. As well. So it's not that you stop becoming a follower and then you're a leader. You're still continuing your followership journey all the way through. You just also happen to be a formal leader at this point as well. So are you going to be a leader that's following, and then you're going to be the decision maker, if you will, but then still continue to be, we'll just use words just because for the sake of it, continue to be a jackass. Well, then there you go. You're a jackass follower attempting to be a good leader as well. And can that really be effective? And I think the answer is not really.
Not really.
Yeah. So what's, I want to ask this question, because we've talked about, being vulnerable. We've talked a lot about just a lot of great concepts, but you, Chief, what is one of the biggest challenges that you faced when you were an early leader, an emerging leader in your career? And how did you navigate through that challenge?
Well, I think my biggest challenge was what we just talked about. I was not a great follower. Hmm. I was very mouthy. I had all kinds of opinions and wasn't afraid to share them. And I think the biggest challenge I had when I first had the opportunity to be a formal leader was credibility. I had to earn the trust of those that I was trying to lead. I had to show everyone that I wasn't who you remember. And a lot of that comes with, I think a lot of that comes with age, it comes with wisdom, it comes with experience. In my organization, you can get temporary appointments, right? So if you have a lieutenant who's going to be off for an extended period of time, mm-hmm. they will pull someone from the list to kind of be the long-term substitute teacher.
Yeah.
and I had a guy who went out. He went out for a lot of injuries over his career. So I don't remember what it was. I think it was a shoulder. But it gave me like a 9-month temporary appointment. And so I got a crew for like 9 months. Right. And so it's not just keeping the plate spinning. If you're going to be there for that long, mm-hmm. you actually have an opportunity to, to change or to really lead people.
Yes.
And it wasn't until I had that opportunity that I began to see kind of what made this so cool, right? What made formal leadership so appealing?
Mm-hmm.
Because when I took the test, I really, frankly, I didn't have much interest in promoting. It was just, I skipped a couple of tests from when I was eligible. It was just time. It felt like it was time.
Sure.
And so I took it and really had no interest.
Mm-hmm.
But as I took that crew and I had an opportunity to lead them over an extended period of time, I started to see what made it so appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an opportunity to help a struggling firefighter who was kind of having a hard time keeping his motivation.
Yeah.
I had another firefighter who in reality was being under challenged. And it became apparent to me almost by accident that, oh, that's what's going on here. Mm-hmm. No one's challenging you.
Yeah.
Like you're super capable.
Yeah.
But no one's challenging you. And because no one's challenged you, everyone thinks you're lazy.
Mm-hmm.
You're not lazy. You're far from lazy.
Yeah.
Right. And so all these things that I learned as I was kind of going through that experience And I think in the way that I interacted with these individuals, right, of taking the guy that just needed to be challenged, to taking the guy who was struggling and helping to brainstorm ways that we could influence the things that we could in his professional life and accept the things that we couldn't. I think that earned me some credibility. And I began to kind of dig out of that hole, if you will, that I created because of the follower I was before I had that opportunity.
Wow. So it sounds like, because you mentioned credibility, and you obviously mentioned having the opportunity to be in that role, to be, you know, to have a crew and so on and so forth. But obviously not everybody has that opportunity, if you will. And there's a lot of individuals, right? I could even throw myself in that. There's a lot of individuals out there that will just say has a lack of credibility prior to or even stepping into that new role as a formal leader. So it does take, and it's kind of a rhetorical question, but I'm just going to throw it out there. It does take added work to earn. You talked about you had to then earn their trust, because the trust either may not have been there or you weren't as credible as maybe some others. But then it just goes back to, again, kind of what you said, is being a good follower all along the way from day one. Because let's just throw this out there as well. Not all of us, not all company officers necessarily wanted to be company officers all along. They maybe at some point in their career, they have an epiphany. Maybe they had a great leader, a company officer, supervisor that kind of pushed them and helped them realize. Because I believe that's another quality, we'll say, another, you know, job of a good coach and a good supervisor is getting the subordinates to help them realize their potential, right?
Absolutely.
It's one thing to, you know, be an individual that says, you know what, I'm going to be a company officer one day, or I'm going to be the fire chief one day. But there's individuals out there that may not have that feeling from day one, but it's the job of formal leaders, in my opinion, to get people to maybe realize this is something that they should be doing because they're good at it or for whatever other reason. So, but going back to followership, I think that's just like you said, I'm glad we went there. It starts with being a good follower along the way, because there's less of in my opinion, there's less of needing to build credibility if you were a good follower all along.
For sure.
So going back to the main topic of the day, we talked about vulnerability. So regarding vulnerability here, Chief, how would you suggest a firefighter early in their career, will say, that they embrace that vulnerability is okay for an individual? They've been here 6 months, they've been here a year, they've been here 5 years. For them to say, you know what, being vulnerable is okay, and I don't need to feel like it's being viewed as a weakness. What would you suggest to new firefighters to start doing to embrace vulnerability?
Yeah, I think vulnerability, like we talked about earlier on, it can be something as simple as, I'd like to work on this, or I need help here, or you know, I honestly don't remember how to do this or how to do that, or I don't know the answer to that question. And so it can start in a very, I won't say, yeah, no, in an innocent way. And maybe you start with, you know, the next up in front of you, maybe not even the senior firefighter, but whoever's that kind of like 3, 4, 5 year firefighter. And that's the person that you kind of try on the vulnerability, right? Try it on for size, see how it fits, see what kind of a reaction you get on something that's really safe. Right. And if you have a good experience with that individual who's like, no, yeah, totally, let me show you, blah, 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 whatever. Then you build your confidence in vulnerability. I just think back to how unhappy I was trying to hide my weaknesses, right? As a young firefighter, as a young paramedic, you know, trying to prove to everyone that I belong there. You know, I didn't come up through a firefighting family. You heard how I got interested in the fire service. It was on a whim. So there was a lot of imposter syndrome in the young Scott Booth firefighter. Boy, that's just a miserable place to live.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And so it really just starts with being intentional about, in a measured way. I get it. Some people are more guarded than others. Some people are more open than others, and that's all okay.
Yeah.
There is no right or wrong way to live your life. I'm not here suggesting that everyone needs to completely flip and become this completely different person. But if everyone who's listening to this can look for an opportunity to be a little more vulnerable in some way. While they're at work, whatever you're comfortable with. If it's something as simple as saying, I could use some help in this area. If it's something like, I don't know, if it's owning a past mistake,
yeah,
that can be particularly powerful, especially for a formal leader. Just push yourself outside your comfort zone.
Yeah.
In my experience, it is rare to find someone who will see that weakness and attack it.
Yeah.
That is rare.
Yeah.
Most people who, when they're confronted with vulnerability, it actually is pretty disarming. And
it could be empowering. It could be.
Absolutely. Yeah. I get that it's scary. And I don't know what your culture is like in your organization. I know in this organization, in my culture, I would say for the last decade or more, vulnerability has been celebrated. And it's because Chief Burgess and now Chief Doan have both led with vulnerability.
Mm.
And they weren't shy about it. And they weren't ashamed of it.
Yeah.
It was just the way that they, it's just the way they lead.
Oh, I love that. And I think what's powerful, just to recap what you said, is mastering the terms, if you will. I need help in this area. I don't know. I don't understand this. Can you please help? And lastly, ownership of a past mistake. And what that comes down to, I think, is honesty. And right, we tell people that honesty is a trait that we all need as firefighters. And if you're not taking ownership of a past mistake and you're not saying, you know, can I need help? I made a mistake. Can you help me? Are we truly being honest? I think the answer is no. So I think honesty is a key portion in being vulnerable. So for a young company officer, and I know this is likely the same. It is the same. But if any, in addition, you have a new emerging leader, right? A new company officer, maybe a new aspiring officer. How would you suggest that they embrace vulnerability? And so they're looked at as this new company officer embraces vulnerability and it's not a weakness. And for that company officer to be okay with that, because we can, let's just go and throw it out there. Like, new company officers will say there kind of could be a feeling of, well, I need to make sure that I, you know, don't show weakness. I am the new person. I need to show that I deserve this role. I got this command presence, whatever you want to define it or say it. But how do we suggest that new officers embrace vulnerability as a strength?
Yeah. Some of the research participants were quick to point out that when I asked, I had a question that was specifically, do you see vulnerability as an asset or a liability? That's the way I worded it. I found, I interviewed 10 people. They were pretty well spread out across 0 to 5, all the way up to 20 plus years of a service. And what I found was that the more, the younger firefighters that I interviewed, they were more likely to see vulnerability as a liability because they were tying it directly to the company officer's leadership qualities on the fire ground. And so what I would say is for the new officer is to look for opportunities to be vulnerable off the fire ground, right? Because the research suggests that it's easy for a firefighter to misinterpret vulnerability on the fire ground because they're relying on you to keep them safe, right? They're relying on you to make the right choices, to have the right tactics. They're relying on you to make sure they get to go home. And it's too easy to misinterpret vulnerability in that context. I would say to the new leader, I mean, if you are someone who accepts a position of leadership in the fire service, you're almost always accepting leadership of a team, right? Almost always until you get to my level where you're, you know, an army of one and super boring and whatever. But you're always agreeing to be the designated adult on a team. I said it before, I'll say it again. If you think you are the most important person on that team, then you probably have a little bit too high an opinion of yourself. Right? This firefighting is a team sport. Yes. And it requires the input and the expertise and the skills of every member of that team to be successful. And so in the context of your team, knowing that the team is what makes the group strong, not you as the company officer, I think you start by tapping into those strengths that you can recognize in those, in the people on your team.
Yeah.
And maybe it's, hey, you know what, in this area, you are better than me in this. So I'm going to rely on you to help guide us.
Yeah.
Right. And I personally, that feels like a very safe way to express vulnerability.
Yeah.
Because you're not saying I'm weak, don't trust me. You're saying you're strong and we're all going to trust you.
Oh, I love that.
Right.
And
the reality is it's going to make the team more effective. There was an example from my paper. One of the firefighters shared that he was on, I think it was structural protection, part of a strike team on a deployment within the state. And he said that the reason why I'm trying to remember the context is that the company officer on this engine wasn't a wildland geek, right? A red card guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this company officer said to the crew, which included this member, hey, listen, guys, this isn't my area of expertise,
mm-hmm.
right? I know I'm the lieutenant, but I'm really going to rely on you to help us make decisions and to keep us safe. And he said that lieutenant's willingness to express vulnerability in that way, he said, not only strengthened the team, but it made the team more effective.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. It can't be scary to acknowledge the strength of a subordinate or a teammate.
Absolutely.
How can that be scary? Right.
Right. Right.
Unless that threatens your own self-perception.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. And I love how you say that, because I wrote some things down, and it goes to empowering your members, acknowledging that they are subject matter experts in many arenas that I am not. Right. And it goes to the very basics of a crew dynamic. For example, the firefighter, the jump seat firefighter, is the expert at taking hydrants and pulling hose. I hope more so than the company officer. I hope more so than the battalion chief. The engineer is the subject matter expert in driver operator and engineering and the apparatus and all the above.
Yeah,
so for the company officer to feel like that they are the subject matter expert, you're taking away from the empowerment of others. And that is just the way you said that, it just clicked in my mind that it is okay to allow someone to say, you are the expert. Would you mind sharing? Would you mind teaching? Would you mind helping us become better because of your knowledge, skills, and abilities? And it's not me, the formal leader, that has to feel like they have the answers to everything, because we shouldn't, nor do we. Well said there, Chief. So you are a chief officer. Chief, obviously.
Yes.
I'm not going to let this one slide if we have to go here. So for a chief officer, battalion chief, assistant chief, deputy chief, division, fire chief themselves.
Yep.
How can one of your level model vulnerability to their people?
Yeah, I think it's very much in the same way that I just spoke of the company officer is recognizing that you have extraordinarily talented people below you. The higher you... When I was a battalion chief, what I saw myself as, honestly, was I was the person that certainly was like the big picture, eyes open, but my job was to get resources for the people in front of me, i.e. doing the work, so that they can be successful.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. That was my job. My job was resource management. At the end of the day, they know I'm not going to tell them how to throw the ladder. I'm not going to tell them how to advance the line. I'm not going to tell them this or that. When you tell someone to do search, you don't tell them do a right-hand search and go to the bedrooms for it. You don't do any of that.
Yeah.
They're the ones that do that work.
Exactly.
So as you get even higher and you're more disconnected, the way that you express a vulnerability is you just are super honest about that.
Honest.
Right.
There it is. Yeah.
I said something on one of the points that when we were working through before the podcast started, is remember where you came from.
Mm-hmm.
Was one of the things that I had written down for the chief officer. And it wasn't like that's often used, like, hey, remember where you came from? Like you've forgotten, like you're disconnected or you're whatever, you're oblivious to the plight of the frontline firefighter. The way I'm saying it is to remember what it was like to be new, to struggle,
mm-hmm.
right? To deal with really, really hard calls.
Yeah.
And to not get a lot of sleep and all those other things That's what I want chief officers to be doing, is to, in essence, show a lot of empathy for the people they're leading, right? Because yeah, you did it once, mm-hmm. and arguably you're in a position now where it's not appropriate for you to continue to do that every day, because then you wouldn't be effective what you're trying to accomplish, you know, at headquarters. But remember where you came from, show some empathy to the people you're leading, and don't take yourself so darn seriously, right? Like, it, again, acknowledge the powerful, wise people that are below you that are doing phenomenal work every day, actually taking care of the citizens, right? Because that's what we're here for.
Yep.
It's not for me to have to work on a wellness program, right? The wellness program serves the firefighters, which serves the citizens, but I'm not serving the citizens mm-hmm. directly, mm-hmm. right? And so you need to give the credit where it's due. You need to remember what it was like to be dealing with all the things that you dealt with that you don't have to experience every day anymore, right? Just pour down that appreciation for the folks that are still doing the work.
Yeah.
And don't take yourself so darn seriously.
There you go. Support your people as best you can in any way that you can, and don't take yourself too seriously. Listeners challenge. Challenge everyone today listening, right? Challenge everyone to start doing something, starting now.
Yep. I think I already said it. I'm going to have to say it again. I would be thrilled if everyone who's listening to this podcast would look for an opportunity to be a little more vulnerable than they're comfortable with.
There you go.
And again, you decide what that looks like.
Yep.
Right? You decide how to express that. But I want... If I could just like mandate something, and I obviously can't mandate, but if I could really, really encourage everyone to do one thing that was a little more vulnerable than they're comfortable with, and just to see what happens, right? Because I honestly think the proof is in the pudding.
Absolutely.
I think for a lot of folks listening to this, it's going to be very well received.
Yeah.
And for the ones that get taken advantage of because of it, I don't know what to tell you other than give me a call and let's go grab a cup of coffee and talk about
it. Yes, I agree. And this is it's obviously something that you can't quantify. Again, it's not quantifiable, but I say this a lot, and when I whether we do the listener's challenge or a challenge of some sort, is imagine, right? Let's all imagine, all the listeners here as well as you and I, imagine the culture change that is implemented. If we all did exactly what you said, we all just made a conscious decision today that each and every one of us are going to be a little more vulnerable, just a little bit, right? And no one's saying how, to what extent, but in a decision that we make, a policy that's written, or just the way we interact with each other, whatever it may be, we all just take a 1% increase in showing vulnerability. What would the fire service look like? Exactly. Again, unquantifiable, but we can all imagine and agree that we become better. Tremendously, totally. You know, 1% by all of us is where massive change starts to happen. So that's the listener's challenge, Chief, the leadership challenge. So obviously we're here today for many reasons. I know we had your fire chief here on the podcast. We've had the Wolfpack here. Many individuals would have agreed and appreciate the fact that Assistant Chief Scott Booth is on the kitchen table today. But we get to ask you now, is there someone out there that you would like to challenge to be a future guest, to share leadership on the kitchen table?
You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to identify someone internal to my organization or if I wanted to look outside of Gig Harbor. And I'm still a little undecided, but I think the person I'd like to challenge is, he's already been identified. He'll be taking the seat on January 1 as the Deputy Chief of Operations with Gig Harbor. And his name is Nick Langlow. He's currently Battalion Chief on A-Shift. And I admire Nick a lot. We've done a lot of work together over the years, both in and out of local leadership. He's a man of unimpeachable integrity. And he's got some really, really good ideas about how to not only effectively lead a team, but how to effectively lead oneself. And so I think he'd be a really good guest. to come on here and just talk about some of his ideas.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. I always appreciate and honored and humbled that an individual such as yourself and our guests would continue to put a name out there to say, you know what, this individual would be phenomenal to talk leadership on the show, to share their experiences, perspectives, and knowledge. So I'm pretty sure I could obtain his contact information. I've got a good contact in front of me that probably looks that works very closely with him. So I'll reach out to obtain either a phone number or an email or both. And I will reach out to Battalion Chief, soon to be Deputy Chief of Operations, Nick Langlow, to see, to let him know that he was leadership challenged. Before we close on the kitchen table today, what would you like to leave our listeners with as far as a lasting leadership thoughts on the kitchen table?
No one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. But I think that there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in that statement.
Agreed.
And I mean, it speaks for itself.
It does. I just want to thank you, Chief, for taking your time today on this busy afternoon. For first of all, being a guest on the kitchen table and sharing the phenomenal message on vulnerability, something that we all listeners need to can embrace a little bit more of to become more effective leaders. So with that, thank you everybody for tuning in today to the kitchen table. We truly hope that you found this time valuable, and we hope that we've inspired you to take action, to lead, and to spread the leadership conversation. Till next time, be safe, be intentional, and stay curious.